Welcome. This is Bob and Cameron. And it's been 5 weeks or so since we last recorded. We had a lot of personal stuff to do and couldn't get back to the phones. So we are starting on page 160, the section 5 called the anthropomorphic physical, AP in brackets. But talking to Cameron just before we started recording, we want to go back to 158 and go in depth into a quote that we glossed over. So this quote is from page 297 of Take Today, The Executivist Dropout by Marshall and Barry Nevitt, 1972. And it's on the last page of the book, page 297. And it's the big wrap-up, and it goes like this. The familiar idea of, quote, making the news now yields to making the world itself. For the best part of a century, we have been programming human consciousness with retrievals and replays of the tribal unconscious. The complementary of this process would seem to be the natural's in quotes, the complementary of this process would seem to be the natural program for the period ahead. Then it has in italics, programming is a colon, and then in italics, programming the unconscious, now this is the natural program for the period ahead, programming the unconscious with the recently achieved forms of consciousness. Then normal print, this procedure would evoke a new form of consciousness radically different from former consciousness. So McLuhan's implying a kind of alchemy he's going to do. He does use the word alchemy in an article titled 1955 about Finnegan's Wake. So alchemy is in his bailiwick. So this quote, Marshall was gone the end of 1980. So then Barry Nevitt was the guy to talk to. So somewhere in there, I asked him, what are the recently achieved forms of consciousness? And he said Finnegan's Wake. Now, I tell that story a lot. I probably said it on this series, and I don't know if I said it. We're at episode 75 here. I say that point. And so I've thought about that for over 40 years, what it means. Made a lot of progress, I think. So we're now helping Cameron to understand it, or his translation will help me understand it. That's how we ended the last episode with the loop-to-loop. Is Cameron imitating Bob, or is Bob imitating Cameron? That's the question. So, as usual, Cameron has something to say. What would you begin to say about this quote,
Cameron? Well, let's just start with what Barry had to say.
Yeah.
I think that what he had to say about Finnegan's Wake as the recently achieved form of consciousness is both right and wrong. It's wrong in the sense that McLuhan almost certainly had a whole range of other ideas in mind. So symbolist poetry, for example, anthropology, analytic psychology, all of these recently achieved forms of consciousness, I think are meant at the end of Take Today. On the other hand, Finnegan's Wake can be seen as a kind of synopsis of these developments in the latter part of the 19th century and then the 20th century. And so in that sense, what Nevitt has to say is correct. So I would just say that the way to take Barry's pronouncement is to be careful to tease it apart and to think of the complications that are involved in what seems like a simple statement.
Well, the Finnegan's Wake, till recently, was not a well-known book. And 99% of people who ran across it ran from it.
Sure.
When I was in New York in the 90s, starting in late 93, I found the Finnings Wake Reading Group and joined it and stayed with them for many years. And there were in the 90s, the group started popping up all over the place. So by 95, there were about 52 of them. And so something about the 90s made Finney's Wake appear to be accessible. So you go back to that quote in 1970 in a letter to the editor of Playboy by McLuhan saying that T.S. Eliot's auditory imagination, I think that's the phrase, written about in the 1920s, was normal awareness today, says McLuhan in 1970. But he says Finnegan's Wake has not become part of the ordinary consciousness yet. But he predicted it would at some point. He implied it. So we had over the past, so that's 50 years ago, 53 years ago, we've had like, I don't know, the last 7 years or something, this popular phenomenon in the journalistic news headline world, the woke, is a major meme running around referring to something. And I, at some point over the last 7 years, just, wow, there it is. People don't know it. Like in the 1970 with the music, electronic music explosion of rock and everything, people didn't know Eliot's quote. And they wouldn't know what McLuhan meant, but they were living it out. McLuhan said we were living entirely by music back then. So the acoustic imagination became a figure of idolatry almost. So pagan idolatry. So here it is at some kind of conclusion of technological communication among people, the most fantastic layout, which I many years ago called the Android meme. And now I say it's become psychopathic, so I call it the tech body. But to have people talk about being woke as if it's obvious what we should do, and yet it causes the most division. And, of course, if you talk to the so-called leaders of the woke movement, they can't define it. So this is an example of something in consciousness caused by the technology of the day that evokes, just like in the 60s, the phrase, where it's at, everybody adopts it. Another word from the 60s, freak out. It's amazing. You know, Zappa coined the word freak out, made it popular, and nobody knew Zappa stuff. But, you know, by 1980s, your grandmother says, oh, yeah, I was freaked out. Yeah. You know, Sam Cameron, how that word became used by everybody? And it was...
Yep.
What?
No, you're right. And this, you could say that the topic here is language.
Yeah.
The question is how does language develop in a largely unconscious way, which then evokes new forms of consciousness?
Yes, it points to reasonably cheap forms of consciousness. So, right. Have you thought of woke? The popularity of that word in terms of Finnegan's Wake last few years?
Well, you mentioned, I hadn't, but you mentioned the association of Wake and Woke a few programs ago, if I remember correctly.
Right, so you hadn't thought of that, so I get credit for articulating.
Yeah. You're the man, Bob.
Yeah. Now, I've also said over the past 10 years, as social media became so such anarchy, and in the 90s email was anarchy for a lot of people. They didn't like it. A lot of crudity and rudeness happened, a lot of threatening people's identities. So to me, more and more, because I was looking at the Wake for all the time I was in New York, and even when I came to Maui, a page of Finney's Wake looked to me like a Facebook page. The threads and the way people talked. And you could go into, you know, more radical places. Reddit, is it called? You go into Reddit, these different places, and it's so like Phineas Wake, and the misspelling and everything of people's communications, and the range of attitudes and postures of mind that are taken. I thought, wow, Phineas Wake, it painted where we arrived. And that's why McLuhan was pointing out the value of the wake. It wasn't a novel. It wasn't a painting. What was it? But it showed you and indicated this could be seen in all media, if you could start to understand McLuhan's interpretation of it. You could see it showed our time. Joyce knew that communication, or felt that communication, was going to take over in a way that would become a monster. And that's what he did. And that's, and then now, what is woke? Woke means some kind of respect for every possible tribe, anthropomorphic tribe, you could say, that's out there. You have to be very careful what you say. So people became very aware of communicating with everybody. And then I would say that confirms my term in 1999 of cloning ESP. Everybody's in a very sensitive, almost ESP level, and you must be aware. You must understand the effects of what you're saying. So another level is everybody's forced to be a media ecologist, as McLuhan said, to look at the environment and be careful of how you say it and where you say it and even what you say. All that, all those aspects I just said are part of being woke. Yet it comes across as an irritant to most people, to the somnambulists, the motivated somnambulists, who are not always wrong. They're tuned into the present. They're just more consciously stuck in the effects of it and have no clue of how they got there. But they register what's going on, and they say there's something off about this. I think it's the majority view. Well, what's interesting is the majority on the street or in the suburbs that these woke people have gone too far, but corporations and the, quote, elites of society, the managers, are implementing it. That's what's interesting, right?
Sure. Well, they, at least in my mind, the term woke means not awake.
Well, they're saying you must become, they say I'm woke, so they say they've woken up, but they admit they were asleep.
Well, but, you know.
From our point of view, yeah, they ain't woke. Is that what you're saying?
I don't believe that people use the term woke in a positive sense. You seem to be saying that, the media, the mainstream media, believes that wokeness is good or something, but they believe what wokeness designates is good, but they don't like the term woke.
Yeah,
nobody does.
I just occurred to me now, it's usually about issues that nobody is guilty of.
It's a kind of conscious manipulation that everybody hates, and nobody admits doing. But at the same time, it's completely enveloped the whole culture.
Yeah. What I mean is most. What'd you say? Main Street. Oh, that's actually a word.
Main Street Media,
Main Street Media. The average person, the so-called average person, is saying, I'm not racist. My people at my work, we're not racist. They don't understand what the complaint, where that came from, you know? Now, if you get into a sociologist or some ideologue, or a Marxist or a humanist or something, they'll say, no, there's racism in America. But that is not noticing the tribal warfare that McLuhan predicted would come. At least on the, I call it in the TV body, cultural warfare is the icons. You must respect the icons of all the different tribes, discarnate tribes, floating among the signs of our time, right? And so you're supposed to respect them. And most people have succumbed to that. But they don't see why people should make a big issue out of it. We're doing it as best as we can. And the people who are woke say, no, you're not. you're suppressing everything even worse. So
right, but you see, before you used the term alchemy,
yeah,
and compared that to both what McLuhan was doing and what's generally going on, and I think that's a very good term, because alchemy was doing some very good work with what would come to be known as chemicals, but it didn't know what it was doing.
Right.
And the good work that it was doing was not only in alchemical laboratories, it was working with materials that are everywhere. Right. And so when chemistry was born partly out of alchemy around 1800, what people found out was about everything that had always been going on forever, right? But they didn't know.
Right.
So
and then
we're
was,
in a... We're
and
in
then,
a,
let me just say this. So, yeah. So they discovered that the search for knowledge, the landing point represented by chemistry, was right in front of them all the time.
Correct. And their brains, the brains that were operating on those materials were themselves chemical.
Yeah.
Right? So I mean, you have loop within loop within loop, and the it's not enough to say that you have to become conscious of these loops, because we're actually hyper-conscious in transhumanism and all of these sort of woke disciplines, we're hyper-consciousness of the loopiness, but we don't really know what's going on.
Well, or we're not comfortable with it, or they don't think people are actually getting it. They're not getting what should be gotten, which might get to some social peace of understanding.
Correct. Yep.
And they just see the understanding is getting less and less. So what are people claiming they're woke about? They're obviously not woke on the right issues. But there is a wokeness. There is a collective consciousness that McLuhan said we arrived at by the 60s in the global theater. Everybody's tuned in on a level playing field with the headlines. So nobody could say that they weren't informed about what to do with it, how to, quote, solve the issues. That's where the division happens, and that's where you get all the different bureaucracies and movements and cults and all kinds of things arguing over how to deal with it.
Absolutely. So notice that McLuhan from the mid-1940s had been saying that a central clue to all this sort of stuff is a page of a newspaper. And so a page of a newspaper is sort of like Finnegan's Wake, in that you have a ton of stuff that's all thrown together. There's no unity to it except for the dateline.
Mm.
And in Finnegan's Wake, there's no unity to it except that the book starts at a certain point, goes to the end, and then starts up again, right? And so it's a bound volume that's just more or less like a dateline.
Yeah.
So the
it's a commentary on Ulysses, which is a dateline.
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So then taking that metaphor, we can imagine that what's going on in the world is that on a newspaper page, the different stories, the different captions, the different pictures, the different cartoons, the different dates, the different numbers, each of these is trying to impose itself on the rest. And what the jump from alchemy to chemistry shows is that you cannot take anything from the old regime and think that it's going to supply an intelligibility for the new one.
Right.
Right. That's our situation is always that we're trying to find intelligibility in the rearview mirror, when that's exactly what denies intelligibility.
and doesn't recognize how much things have changed with every new environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, back in the 60s, the humanist movements, the radical movements, everybody was saying, we got to wake up the people. So by the 80s, on my radio show, me and the poet Ian Arlott used to say, we're here to drive you to sleep.
Yeah, that's good. You folks are too awake.
We're what? Too what?
The folks out there are too awake.
That's right. And yeah. I was right. And people were trying to find out how to get back to what they call peace of mind and stuff. They were trying to get back in their bodies again. Get somewhere. It's no fun floating around dealing with paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy every day, right? The different expressions of it. So the woke, McLuhan, he said, I think in the Hot and Cool interview with Stern, my sources are esoteric. So he was lucky to become aware of Mallarmé and the symbolists and a lot of people in North America had no awareness of it. He didn't get any of it at Winnipeg, I don't think, at the University of Manitoba.
No. That came from Gideon.
Yeah.
When he met Gideon in 43, the same year he met Lewis, Gideon wrote him a postcard, I think from Europe. And in that postcard, he said that he didn't think McLuhan knew enough about French poetry and that he should start with Apollinaire.
Right.
And probably McLuhan did that. And by the end of the 1940s, he was doing Mallarmé almost every day with I think she was a graduate student / teaching assistant at UT who was an expert in Mallarmé. I think she was doing her PhD on Mallarmé, and he was sitting with her every single day.
What was her name?
I can't remember. I'll look it up and I'll send it to you.
Yeah, not Sheila Watson.
No,
later.
No. Yeah, this is...
Where do you come across that information?
I can't remember.
Okay. Well, you found it in your scrounging in the garbage of our civilization. You found it.
Yeah.
So he felt, well, I would say one was lucky to discover that stuff early. And I was lucky to discover Finnegan's Wake. I mean, people didn't know that. But if you kept it in mind and puzzled over it and stayed with it, you all of a sudden were on the leading edge of everything as society went extreme in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So McLuhan was lucky in finding esoteric sources. I always felt I was lucky, but I was going with what he told me, and then I found some other stuff. But that was a big deal to become aware of these new forms from the 19th century. If you didn't know that's what the leading European poets were doing, you were pretty naive about what was coming. And you see a lot of people did that in the 40s and 50s, discovered Mallarmé. I'm sure Ginsberg and those people, they celebrated Rambo. Jim Morrison celebrated Of the Doors, celebrated Rambo. That it became popular cliche eventually by the 70s as people discovered it in the 60s. I don't even know if they found out from McLuhan, one or two professors might have, but it was in the air to become aware of these European poets.
Yes, well, I mean, the late 1940s and 1950s had all kinds of professors emigrating from Europe into the United States.
Yeah.
And so there was, as McLuhan was very conscious of, there was a new kind of intellectual exodus that was like the exodus that followed the fall of Constantinople in 1453.
Yeah.
So all of the Greek scholars left the new Turkish Empire
and came west, often to Italy, and introduced a new type of consciousness to Europe. And according to McLuhan, that same sort of thing happened after the Second World War.
Yeah. So the when you talk about the Renaissance, a new form of consciousness, it would be new forms of new retrieved manuscripts?
Sure, but also new ways of thinking, types of historical knowledge. It was a brain drain out of the East to the West.
Yeah.
And this was something that Etienne Gilson had done a lot of research on, and it was sort of common knowledge at St. Michael's that this type of intellectual migration was one of the spurs of Western civilization.
And the printing press created a canceling, a new problem, extension, numbness, that challenged or misdirected or obsolesced the content of the Renaissance.
Yeah, but you could say that it introduced a sort of complication that McLuhan, following Havelock and others, said was what produces high culture. So according to McLuhan and Havelock, what happened in classical Greece was that you had the oral tradition come together with the literal innovation. And then you have the same thing again in Elizabethan England, where you have the oral culture of medieval England coming together with a new literate consciousness. So the idea here is that when you have a clash of mentalities, a clash of sensibilities, that can give rise to high culture.
And wasn't the term from Herolinus, Minerva's owl? Wasn't that his metaphor for that?
Well, I mean, I think that's an interesting insight. For Minerva's owl is an image that comes from Hegel. And what Hegel meant by it, and what Harold Innison using it as the title of an important lecture, what they were thinking of was that high culture signals the imminence of decline.
Mm. Yeah.
So when Hegel said that the owl of Minerva takes its flight only in the evening, what he means is darkness is falling at the very time that the owl of Minerva takes its brilliant flight.
Right, and that's the supernova of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the supernova of the 50s what are people becoming aware of that McLuhan was ahead of everybody on, or on top of it, surfing it? What was the Minerva's owl? What was declining in the 50s? Literacy? Books? Or was it early
all
electronic telegraph era?
The thing that was in great decline was the unanimity of culture.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the print effect.
Yes.
So at first it was perceived as the the death of God, the death of the book, illiterate values, civilization, and the beatniks were the popular expression of that repudiation, right?
Correct.
Their
yes,
poetry was not accepted by the major literate poets of the day. They were street anarchists. They were hooligans, rock and rollers. Dope addicts, but they end up defining the culture. And I always thought it's interesting that McLuhan's Playboy interview is in March 69. And what is the next issue? April 69 is Allen Ginsberg, who at the time Marshall had a big photo in his coach house of. And I think it's Zarbox, Altman, a new video of him, or I don't know when he did it. It might be on Frank Zingroni, or I don't know where I saw it. It just the other day, we were looking at it, and it flashes by of McLuhan in the coach house, and there's the poster of Ginsburg. Now, in 1980, when I was in, 2000, on just moving to City Island out of East Side, Upper Manhattan, there was an article on McLuhan, like September 2000. Don't remember why, but the New York Times had this picture of McLuhan lying on a couch, and he's sort of underneath this big photo in the coach house of Ginsburg. So it looks like he respects Ginsburg.
Sure.
Or, you know, he's I think he's a pretty big deal. But you know Marshall considered that the environment he wanted to provide in any environment to. And later, Walter Bower told me that when Ginsburg met McLuhan, he was turned off because McLuhan wouldn't respond to Ginsburg's hug. He stiffened up. So he probably thought McLuhan was some kind of hang-up over gay people. There would be a lot, we know, there would be a lot of other reasons he wouldn't respond to a hug, not chemical body reasons. So
let's just note that Ginsburg and Burroughs were very close, and McLuhan had done his Burroughs piece earlier in that same decade, 1964, I think it was.
Yeah, December 64, Nation magazine.
Yeah, yeah. So it wouldn't be right to say that McLuhan was trying to supply only the anti-environment to Burroughs and Ginsburg, because what he was trying to do was do what he describes in the last sentence of the passage you read from Take Today, 297, right? This procedure would evoke a new form of consciousness radically different from former consciousness. Well, that is the sort of thing that he wanted to do for Burrow and Ginsburg, and by extension to the whole cultural nexus, but not by canceling them.
Right.
By showing what they were.
The ground to them as figures.
Absolutely. Exactly. Just like when chemistry is born, it doesn't change stuff. What it does is it specifies what's going on and what always has gone on.
Right. Now, here's what's interesting. In the late 70s, McLuhan said to me, Burroughs came up. He was reading, I think, Third City, or I think that's a Burroughs book. It was on his table, you know, just before his stroke. And he said to me, I don't know why he picked me to say it to, but he said, Bob, don't hang out with the Burroughs people. That's a bad scene. So he made a moral, personal judgment about the Burroughs scene. Burroughs was starting to get a lot of attention, having a revival at that period. And so there's Marshall giving his personal opinion, which he would never do in public media. And he was dealing with a different point, which you just spelled out eloquently, of what the Burroughs scene meant. It had nothing to do with judging his lifestyle or how much of a junkie he was. That was not significant. But if you actually were, quote, a student around him, he'd give you a warning just for not to really, on a practical level, to get sucked into the latest fad. It was interesting getting these personal comments, and I never took them as relevant to his public self, his discarnate super angel self, commenting on the world with this new kind of poetry. So why?
But notice it does fit together with his public stuff, because his public stuff, he's always advocating inclusive consciousness versus exclusive, right? So you could say he's always talking about wake instead of woke. So I would say what he was saying to you was, these people are dangerous if they are identified with.
If they're identified yet. What, say it again.
With. If they're identified
with. Yeah.
Yeah.
so that as the object of study, or as respectful awareness as of possibilities of human sensitivity, these guys are a great thing to study, but to identify with, or to become part of the group, that's not going to work.
Right. He used to say, people think if I talk about something, I'm for it.
Correct.
That's a great line. Do you know anybody in history of thought who said something like that also?
Well, I mean, I think Eliot is largely about that. I think that's what the men of 1914 were all about.
Yeah.
I think Pound is often about that. Joyce, certainly. Right? If you just think of Ulysses, with every chapter being a different point of view, a different aspect of Ulysses' voyage, a different color, a different type of music, et cetera. It's always a respect for a necessary multiplicity, which is a phrase from Wittgenstein.
Yes, and the popular consciousness was, you know, don't talk about things that will disturb me.
Right.
Don't talk about politics and religion. So if you talked about stuff, you had to be for it. So that was a new way to deal with social interaction, to say, if I'm talking about something, you've been damn sure I'm against it. That was rude, or that was odd to do that, but that was the new sensibility that these men of 1914 picked up on. So, but we're digressing. Now, we were talking about this woke thing. So Marshall has a mediumism massage. The situation leads to, we're going to either have a wake, W-A-K-E, or we're going to be awake, and he said, or make it awake, W-A-K-E, or both. That's the way to describe the woke situation. We're either having a wake, and we could be awake about it, or, and you may not be able to do both, or you could do both. You know, that's the phrase. That's what the way he writes that. It was striking in 1967 in the Mediumism Massage. You know, it was like all he did was, you know, for kindergarten, acted a little discontinuous. Like, he had more than one thought in his mind. So he said, okay, we can make it awake. Or awake, or both. That was new for people, educated
well,
people.
Well, that was, you could say that that was the theme song of the Cambridge English School.
Yeah.
Right, the fundamentality of ambiguity. So what McLuhan was trying to say is that there are two central aspects to ambiguity, and we need both. The first aspect of ambiguity is that nothing makes sense by itself. But the second aspect is that when things don't make sense by themselves, the feeling that is precipitated out of that is one of chaos, despair, lack of orientation. And the second aspect for McLuhan is that exactly this type of fundamental ambiguity can be used for orientation, like a gyroscope.
Would you say, as David Lynch says, he makes these movies, he wants people to explore the underbelly, the dark side. Is that what McLuhan's doing?
Well, it's in part, but think of alchemy becoming chemistry. McLuhan's trying to indicate that exploration is not one that lacks orientation. It's not one that we're at sea and we don't know where we're going and all that stuff. No, we're at sea. The world that we're analyzing is tremendously chaotic, but there's an order to it. And trying to keep a foot in both those camps is a difficult matter, but according to McLuhan, it's a necessary matter.
Yeah. So, have we finished with the woke theme? Have we run into the ground? Do you have...
Maybe. I mean, the interesting thing about wokedom is that it's the attempt to show that in the maelstrom of life, there is a singular value which supplies the orientation that we need. So it's exactly the different path from what McLuhan, Eliot Pound, Joyce, Yeats, etc., are talking about, because it's kind of a last ditch attempt to invoke singularity.
Yeah, the univocal.
And, yeah, absolutely.
I remember. Go ahead.
Well, what people react against is that they feel that the people that grasp this singularity are doing so because it gives them power, and they resent that intuitively.
Yeah. So Don Thiel used to say that an aspect that's not discussed too much was that James Joyce was making fun of people who became apocalyptics, who thought things were coming to an end or dramatic turmoil that could lead to a lot of problems. He was making fun of Fenians being awake, wakened by something they didn't know was creating a new consciousness, and they were interpreting it through old consciousness, and therefore in a panic state.
Sure.
That's an interesting way to look at the wake, that he's always got exclamation marks all through the book, and the same panic is going on every 10 pages, and especially around each of the 10 thunders. So he's showing this repeating theme of upset, cultural upset, and he sees it as somnambulism. So he's not saying,
well,
become awake. You must wake up. Well, that wouldn't be the right way. He wants you to wake up, but the factors that you're not even aware of that you need to notice. So it's not a chemical body waking up. It's not even a mental awareness waking up. It's a perceptual thing, or whatever term you use, that can look across the actions of millions of people and have media report what they seem to be doing. That's
correct.
A new kind of scenario, landscape.
Yeah, and it's notice what Finnegan's wake is. Right, so Finnegan's wake is a wake that is not awake because the person they're waking is dead, is supposedly dead, but he's not dead. And everybody at the wake is drunk, including the dead guy.
Who wakes up?
So what being wake is a very strange matter.
Yeah, I wonder... What prompted him to notice that? Was he dealing with that in Ulysses, the day book, as opposed to the night book? Was he talking about people being asleep? I'm not sure. I guess so. McLuhan's criticism has the denizens of the day are the stone men, the police, the robotic institutional moral or orderly, the ones imposing order. And the nighttime, the people of the moon, and emotion, and these two points, moon and sun, are metaphors that McLuhan used, but are a basic pattern in Ulysses. And then the two books, you got the Book of the Sun and the Book of the Night, and they're pointing to factors that are not books. That's another point. Pointing to the post-book situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we better go back to the quote. I think we're too awake here on a univocal theme. So I find it interesting, the opening sentence, making the news yields to making the world itself. So I see Thoreau take today, he's trying to explain what that world is and how did it get made. And one of the key lines for me is that the word that makes the market, and it's directed at the White House or American politics around the image of the president, the automated presidential surrogate. And you make a world, and it's not, as he begins his PhD, the making of a world through speech. It's a speech drenched with the history of every form of extension of humans at that point in the 60s. And so it's making a world, that's alchemy. And that became the normal business of people, and they had no clue that's what they were doing.
So just think of chemistry for a minute. The world is being made by chemical materials, but up until 200 years ago, nobody knew about it. So the question is the world going to be made the way it always has been made, or is it going to be made in a new way that reflects a new consciousness of how the world always has been made?
Well, I guess the world was always made by social gossip, whatever the tribe community was involved in. So that's making the news. But he thinks he's making a new statement here. The familiar idea of making the news yields to something astounding, making the world itself. So people probably didn't think the news was a made-up world. They thought the news was reporting what the world had arrived at, not that it was making the world. It was reporting on the world that had been made up to that point.
Yeah, but they weren't wrong in a certain sense. That was how the world was being made, but they didn't know how to look at it.
Yeah,
right. You have to put the first sentence of this passage together with the last sentence, right, where you have the new form of consciousness radically different from former consciousness. So the former consciousness can be called making the news, and then making the world can be the new form of consciousness radically different.
Right. So then he goes into the characteristics of the world. So for 100 years, we have been programming human consciousness, programming it with retrievals and replays of the tribal unconscious.
Right.
So people, they didn't think of themselves as tribal in the way McLuhan was talking about it in the 60s. So it was very controversial just using that word. And people argued over whether, are we tribal? Are we going tribal? Not recognizing that it had always been tribal.
Correct.
So, but he's saying that's not what's happening. That's what's sort of interesting. It's not about programming the tribal unconscious. The complementary to this process, which seemed to be the natural program for the period ahead, and he's implying we are doing it, and if you become aware of it, you help in programming the unconscious with recently achieved forms of consciousness, which may be you if you are a media figure. Remember that line in the statement in the NFB film, National Film Board film in 64, Children of the Future or something it was called, and he's talking about the amazing new fact that, you know, young people, children are programming the world. And I would think of the Beatles at that point. That was their big year, 64. You know, to someone like McLuhan, they're just kids. But that was the new fact, right? That the programmers were not the CIA, you know, or the White House. The programmers were figures in all kinds of media.
Yeah. That's I hadn't really thought of that process in the terms that you just put it in. I think that was interesting, and I'll have to give that some more thought. I was thinking along the lines of people investigated primitive tribes in anthropology for the first time starting around 1870 or something like that. And then when that was built into poetry starting around the same time, and built in the music and sculpture and ballet, also starting sometime around then. And then Freud and Jung and the psychoanalytic people were doing something related in psychology. These are new types of human consciousness that are retrievals and replays of what was possible in the unconscious. If they weren't possible in the human unconscious, then they could never have come to light. They could never have become expressions. Mm. But the overview of what was going on was lacking. So there was all kinds of new programming going on, but nobody knew how to program the programming.
So, but McLuhan said that was possible if you knew how to get
exactly.
to it.
Exactly.
So that's where there's the wokeness that we had arrived at. We had arrived at a post-tribal programming. We were programming something else, which you could call it cyborg, all the different things, virtual reality. But there was a programming that everybody was engaging in. They
yeah.
were making the world. And
correct.
That is definitely what the phrase woke should refer to. It's about what we're doing. So it's not about, see, the woke fanatics are demanding you to do something that's not being done. And that's the exact opposite. People are too awake. People are making and programming and not really taking any notice of the consequences of all that. I mean, I just find when you look, and I don't do much of it, but if I watch the talking heads on CNN or any of these major Fox News, the massive irresponsibility of these people on there 24/7 telling us to look at this, look at that, look at that problem. That is really social anarchy. And they're always pointing to the other people who are the anarchists, not them. But they are the anarchists. That's why right. in 1990 I got interviewed by a little magazine in Toronto, and I said, the first terrorist we've got to deal with is Barbara Frum.
Yeah.
And of course,
that was excellent.
Yeah, it was a good statement, and I could have gotten in trouble with it, but it was an obscure little magazine. But then her son became...
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah. the son is a... the perfect expression of what you had described.
Yeah, I predicted her son.
Yeah,
yeah. I would say we gotta get rid of Barbara, or her children are going to be a problem.
Yeah.
That's pretty
and
good.
Her children being all of Canada.
Yeah,
right.
And just
so,
for people don't know, David Frum, what did he program? George Bush the Jr., right?
Yeah,
he was the Iraq War, probably right.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
He was a big proponent, yeah.
You see, Canadian people, they're running the White House. And he's the son of the Walter Cronkite in journalism, but when the right hemisphere took over, so we had to have a woman be Walter Cronkite. And she was known as Barbara Frum, but she died early of a disease. Now, I've told this story before, but just in this context, Tom Wolfe spoke at the University of Toronto in 1977, and Barbara Frum was appointed to... introduce him. So she's sitting up there beside his pulpit place, and McLuhan's off on the side bleachers watching this. So as Wolf started talking, and he was saying things that people were surprised at, he was a good McLuhanite. He knew where to trigger people. And Barbara Frum thought that she had to remain sitting there on the podium right beside the Tom Wolfe, and so she was just looking at the audience. It was a very embarrassing situation for her. But as it unfolded, you could see she didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And as this became more and more obvious, you could see McLuhan over the bleachers laughing his head off. His vengeance on against these Barbara Funds people. Because remember, Mike Wallace interviewed him in 1966 for some obscure thing. That's before 60 Minutes. And he says, so what are you on about, Marshall? What's your agenda? What are you investigating? And he says, I'm investigating you. And so, yeah, the news. Back in the 60s, the word media, people thought, meant the news overload. So he's watching the news archetype, which is someone who makes worlds every day at headquarters, and there's a perceived literate headquarters, and he's watching her being massaged by his understudy, Tom Wolfe. It's quite a hilarious situation. And everybody was uncomfortable, except for Marshall. He loved it. I've never seen him like that. He was off on the side. He had his arms folded, and he was, like, giggling, chuckling, hardly keeping it quiet. And if you looked over, you'd see, well, who's that guy shaking over there? Well, that's McClure. Well, what's he laughing at? It almost could be taken that he was laughing at Tom's feeble attempt to be McLuhan.
Well, the whole scene.
The whole what? Yeah, the whole scene.
The whole scene.
Yeah. So,
from?
I'm glad I saw that. I'll never forget that scene. That spoke a lot to me. And well, that was 77. 13 years later, I'm picking up the ball and saying, well, it's gotten out of hand. She should be sitting on the podium too long. We must remove her. She's a terrorist.
Yeah. So the German term from is probably a variation of Fromm, and Fromm in German means piety.
That's what she was. Yeah.
Yeah, this relates to woke very much.
Yeah. And you and know you, that, or you just looked it up?
No, I just know that.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So, yeah, she is the high priest of the secular religion of being informed and being woke, and you must be aware of what's happening. You must know what disruptions happening to your community today. And then there's arguments over what is your community, what are the boundaries of it. And there turned out there were four worlds, according to McLuhan. So
wasn't her show called As It Happens?
Yes, that was on radio in the 70s before she became the Walter Cronkite. Yeah, I used to listen to that. I was in Nova Scotia. I didn't think that I was being informed by the local media very well, effectively. So I made a point of listening to that a lot. I would just find out what was going on. They'd interview everybody in all stories. It was a good radio show for the period. I certainly was aware of the McLuhan services and disservice situation. I wasn't a naive person. As a matter of fact, about 1975, I was walking down the main street of Halifax, downtown, and there was a CBC reporter, local reporter there, and he jumps on me and says, hey, what do you say about this? Whatever it was, I don't know what. And so it was the first time I was going to be on the media, right? Back then, it was a big deal, man. So there's only one network. In America, they only had three networks. We only had one. And so I started saying, well, the problem is today that we have huge populations being decimated 24/7 in the electric conditions. So I went on to explain the disembodied, discarded situation of the super angels. and the next day, they played it as one of the commentaries about whatever was going on. And a woman, older woman, who ran the Conservative Party of Nova Scotia, a real battle axe in charge of everything.
Blue hair.
Yeah, blue hair. She knew me. And in 7 years before, declared to her son that I was the Antichrist. So life led her, eight years later, to hear me on the radio and to confirm her worst of suspicions. Yeah, I'm on there saying everybody is being murdered immediately by some nebulous force in the world. Just, you know, that's how they would hear it. So that was fantastic that she was who I was talking to at that point. And in my actuality, that's who I wanted to hear me, you know. So it worked. It happened. But that was my attempt to wake up the people.
Your first attempt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. That's right. I've been replaying this for a long time, haven't I? So that was a lucky break. So back to this thing. I think we're making some progress here. So understand, people, that the tribal unconscious has been replayed, retrieved, and due to the electric tribal effect, somnambulistically for 100 years, since the telegraph. And the complementary is And it's a natural program, which means it's inevitable. Something approaching this will happen. And we did arrive at, you know, an update of Eliot's auditory imagination. We are now with Joyce's tactile imagination. I'll call it secondary tactility, not Walter Wrong's secondary orality. Secondary tactility is the consciousness that we're conscious of and not sure how to speak around it. And it was inevitable where we got to today.
Yeah.
And that's so it's a natural program, in quotes.
It occurs to me that all of the new types of consciousness, which were very avant-garde, were replayed by the children that you talked about in the 1950s.
Yeah.
Right? So they... what the children picked up in the 1950s with turn to rock and roll and wearing
Catcher in the Rye,
all this stuff. Yeah, exactly. What they were picking up was the retrievals and replays that the avant-garde 50 and 30 years before had been retailing as high culture, now had entered into language deeply enough and exoterically enough for children to be putting it out.
Yeah, and it also showed that it didn't matter how old you were. Your chemical body boundaries or descriptors weren't relevant. If you had access to the content of the global theater, you were shaping people. Now, you know, and then Warhol comes along and says, well, you only got 15 minutes, so make the most of it. But there was a turnover. But that is what was shocking everybody. So they called the hippies and all that a children's crusade, the older journalists.
Yeah.
Which is a replay of the Troubadour 1200s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before the printing press. So, so what's important is that McLuhan was describing what was happening so accurately, and yet nobody read it, nobody noticed it, and nobody understood it, if they did read it.
Correct. And they, that was happening in a very explicit, very conscious sense when McLuhan was going to corporations like IBM and AT&T, and General Electric, he was saying to these people, look, information is the new economy. You people don't really know what business you're in and all this sort of stuff. Well, none of these corporations understood what he was talking about.
No.
As a matter of fact, he went to Kodak and he said, Parker and I will come down and tell you guys what business you're in, but you have to give us, I forget what the figure was, it was $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever, and I translated the amount of money he wanted, this was sometime around 1970, into dollars today, and it came out to be $40,000. So he was asking Kodak for $40,000 for him and Parker to come down for one day. Well, they didn't want him.
Yeah.
But the thing is, because it was too expensive, right? But it cost the whole corporation. By not having McLuhan and therefore not understanding what he would have told them, Kodak died.
Yeah. Yeah. And
right?
IBM got shattered too in early 80s.
Yeah, and General Electric. So all of the great new big corporations like Google, like Facebook, like Twitter, like Amazon, all of these corporations are built on principles that McLuhan was telling the old corporations, but they didn't listen.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
So billions and billions of dollars were lost.
Yeah, and that's never been said, as far as I know. People might, if they look into read a Tom Wolfe excerpt, what if he's right, that article, 1965, they would see, even today, a young student could read it, they'd see, oh, he went around to these corporations and was sort of odd to them. He told them they didn't know what business they're in. Nobody follows up and says, every one of those ones are gone. And I give you credit for that. That's the first time that's been said in relation to McLuhan. The follow-up on what happened, right? It's very important,
yeah,
what you just said. So the, you know, would you say that of all the icons of the 60s, I mean, you got Norman Mailer, Ginsburg, McLuhan, Tim Leary, Ralph Nader, maybe some right-wingers, the Nazi Party guy, Rockwell. Okay, just take the journalistic icons of the 60s. Would you agree with me, and I say this, that the one who survived and is still seen as relevant is Marshall McLuhan? He's the most quoted,
sure,
guy from that era right now.
And it's becoming more and more the case.
Yeah.
Because the number of people that even heard of McLuhan, let alone read anything by him, is still very small.
Yeah.
But still, the quotations, the citations from McLuhan, from all
are in their, in the articles that they read on their computer.
Correct, correct. But it, but as you say, he's becoming more and more and more relevant to more and more people. And yet, it, there's, you know, very, very little of him is understood. And even less applied. So what's going to happen in the future, if we do have a future, McLuhan is going to turn out to be the figure from that decade that...
From the 20th, second half of the 20th century, we would say.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and the... what was my thought there? The... you know, the harbinger of a lot of this was Wired magazine, 1993. They made McLuhan their patron saint. But that's not exactly what I wanted to say. The so when McLuhan said, you know, Eliot's auditory imagination, he could have said McLuhan's the medium is the message and the medium is the massage will be the people aren't aware of that yet, right? Because he was translating Finnegan's Wake. So he could have said Finnegan's Wake and we'll end up into a woke situation or that cultural reference point, but it's also referring to him. So in the woke period, which resonates with the title, Finnegan's Wake, it also resonates with McLuhan himself and his own image, because that's what he was explaining and predicting.
Yes. Yeah, if you look at the term auditory imagination, you have the ear and the eye.
Yeah.
Right? Auditory ear, imagination, the eye.
Yes.
So then McLuhan comes along and he says the medium is the message. Well, what is the medium? It's not a newspaper. It's the tactility in between the ear and the eye.
Yeah. Good point.
So then the what McLuhan is saying is that the ear and the eye stand in for all possible interrelationships, and if we want to understand the message of all those possible interrelationships, we have to understand the media.
Yeah,
that is to say, the mediating tactility that it is the what might be called the basic form of all of those relations.
Well, we get to secondary tactility. You probably didn't think Walter Ong was keeping up with everything.
No.
Yeah. He dealt with secondary orality, which is, that's T.S. Eliot's auditory imagination. But he missed out on secondary tactility, which is shown in my tiny note chart, the squaring of the tactile environment in the Croker quadrant. They square the tactility. McLuhan is the only other quadrant that mentions tactility, the tactile, in my right column of the chart, the sensory ratios of the time. So tactile is mentioned in McLuhan, but then it then comes into Croker in the fourth quadrant, and it's squared. And that gets into where we are. Somebody has a new McLuhanite. There's this woman who was an employee at Facebook, and a couple of years ago, she quit and went public and complained about Facebook. And I noticed on YouTube she's interviewed. She was on 60 Minutes and all kinds of programs. It's been a big deal. But I just saw her being interviewed the other day. Her name was Frances Haugen. I think it's H-A-U-G-A-N. And so I got a friend to listen to it, and he said, man, there is mediaecology in the normal consciousness today. This woman is trying to be a mediaecologist, as he understands it, what McLuhan was saying. And it's obvious that's what's going on, and she's trying to volunteering. She's the new Ralph Nader to go back into Facebook and get them on the right course with some mediaecology. Now, she came up with the phrase, or I don't know if she came up with it, but she used it, the cyborg theocracy. And that's what I was just about to say. I'm explaining where I heard it the other day.
Yeah, that's a good phrase.
Yeah, cyborg theocracy. Now, that's McLuhan's religious temples. Remember, temple bureaucracies were before the Roman military bureaucracies. So we've retrieved temple bureaucracies in media after images like ABC News or CBC. These are temples of bureaucracy, of trying to impose some kind of a chemical body hierarchy and status, sense of a social order, which is completely irrelevant and failing. And it's a theocracy. You know, it's Tony Schwartz is the second God. This is his title. What is this? The Resonant Chord? What's the name of his book? Anyways, there's another one I think he did, The Second God, which is media. Now, that's another point. The terms in understanding media and the media environments he's describing in his books aren't there anymore. Now, he did anticipate this, and the best way to do it was to keep Finney's wake as a figure. But those environments, they're the analog media that became the content of the Android meme. And they're the after images which have run their course. So in 1970, auditory imagination meant that the virtual temple bureaucracies would take over. So from 1970 to 2010, 2020, 40 or 50 years, the news-making process, which was really more consciously seen as making the world, were the content, the figures. And what was not noticed was the super angelization, the superhumanization of every citizen who got a cell phone. That was really the new hidden ground, the digitalization and holopathizing and turning into gods, quote, gods of the Microsoft and Gates' technology, I guess the Apple products.
But that's the squaring of digitization, you could say.
Yeah, squaring of tactility.
Yeah, but the all of these things are always ambiguous. So the it's the squaring of tactility, but not knowing that that's what it is.
Right.
And when you have a kind of woke unknowing, then you have a cyborgian theocracy, as you were just saying, that it's a woke attempt at a singular value that is inherently ignorant, because there is no singularity and there is no sort of natural value.
And an important word for the singularity is the univocal. The world is still looking for Mr. Univocal, which is the Antichrist, and everybody is competing. They're talking about running for White House, the President of the United States. No, everybody's running to be the guy at the center making the new world and defining it inaccurately, because they're univocal. That univocal is the old medium, which we keep, as McLuhan would say, these are the old tools that don't work today.
Correct.
So you have this polyvocality shown in Finning's Wake. That is the fact. Everybody's engaged. here comes everybody. Everybody's talking to everybody. Everybody's a world maker, and they can't see what world has been made. Like he said, it's recently achieved forms of consciousness, forms of wokeness.
Yeah, so you have, of course, in Ukraine and Taiwan, you have the contest over multipolarity, right?
Yeah.
And so you, the world is ever more conscious, in one sense, of this contest between the unipolar and the multipolar, the univocal and the polyvocal, or I don't know.
Polyvocal.
Multivocal. So the world is becoming more conscious of these things, but in a strangely unconscious way. Right? It's a where the even the people that invoke multipolarity tend to do so as a univocal value.
Yeah. They keep it stuck in the chemical body.
That's right. That's
human
right.
Form. Now that's the AP that we're coming to. That's the best variation of the AP, anthropomorphic physical. But I don't want to just get there yet. But that's good. That's how we get there. What you're trying to say is what I'm going to be trying to point out with this.
Another couple pages.
Yeah.
But isn't one thing that I haven't understood about the chemical body is that aren't all of the bodies that you talk about, whether they're five or six or even seven, aren't they always there, known or unknown, in some kind of dynamic interplay?
Yes, they are interplaying. We live what I call quadriphenia. We've got five bodies.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, the bodies are our images. The chemical body is ruled by the last gasp of the book. Starting in 1850, the book becomes archetype. And so science defines what our body image is. You know, anatomy, psychology, biology, all the terms describing our human physical form. That was locked in by the book, created by the book. Because remember that great quote from McLuhan? He talks about the medieval humors. That was the body image. And then it becomes a pump house in the beginning of the steam engine and the kinetic machines, the body image responds to that environment. And then in the 19th century, we become a bag of chemicals. That's the last image. And now the genetic images, that's something later, but the chemical body is the image that the medical profession is imposing on everybody and getting into problems because we're not that chemical form. The image doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of it following on Carolyn's career. She was an expert in looking at all the alternative modalities, acupuncture, something called energy medicine. And my chart, actually, I have diseases on them, and they're showing the different phases of an attempt to get the body image as the chip body, the chip reality, the chip landscape is molding people. So there were all these fads of dealing with the obsolescence of the drug model and the surgery model in medicine. It just was having a supernova and being overused. And so I document the different popular ailments that reflect the different media quadrants. I never talk much about that. But it's a development of the McLuhan quote, which comes from, I think, Explorations back in the 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
So as the chemical body became more ethereal, more diffuse, more scattered, or what Coker called splayed, S-P-L-A-Y-E-D, the distributive networks of the central nervous system were splayed, people who were a little more open to the failure of the hospital, and it was becoming the new religion, the hospital. You know, and Carol and I met Ivan Illich in 1975, you know, 50 years ago. And Carolyn told him she was in med school. He says, well, I consider all med students new Nazis. That's what he said to her.
Wasn't he a doctor himself?
No, I don't know what he was. He was a priest. And, you know, he's the one that McClellan argued over what should be done in the schools.
Yeah. He had a book called...
De-Schooling Society.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And he was staged down in Cuernavaca in Mexico and had social programs he was advocating. But I never thought of him as a doctor. I don't think he was a medical person. He was just a thinker and a writer. And alienated, you know, he became angry at, I think, the church and became a humanist or a radical guy. So the attempt to form a body image, which McClellan said the Children's Crusade were people trying to establish a body percept. So he actually said in an interview. I think it was
Dallas.
Yeah. Body percept.
Post on that.
Beg your pardon?
I have a post on his language of body percept.
Yeah.
He wrote about that a lot for about a 2 or 3 year period.
Yes.
That's how McLuhan's mind worked. He would adopt an image. He would go over it and over it and over it and finally exhaust it and then just leave it.
Yeah.
Never mention it again.
Right. And the image in 67, he said, he was just beginning to talk about figure and ground. And he said, the hippies were trying to touch the ground with their bare feet.
Yeah.
They couldn't get there with their shoes, obsolete clothing. So they'd take their clothes off to touch the ground. What the kids were doing literally was a metaphor, a symbol of the process that was going on.
Yeah. McLuhan's mind, I think it was Norman Mailer, said that nobody thought in terms of metaphors like McLuhan did.
Yeah.
McLuhan,
you know what Mailer said? He said, I used to think I had a fast mind, but no, I was a loser compared to McLuhan's rapidity of metaphor, which is interesting because he didn't have as many metaphors as Mailer would need in his novels, and McLuhan quotes from Armies of the Night or something, I think in Cliched Archetype, and says it was a very eerie passage he was quoting, but he was complimenting on Mailer's metaphors. And Mailer had to come up with a lot of metaphors, so it's odd that he thought that McLuhan was more metaphorical. But that's because he was dealing with a larger metaphor, which is a figure-ground ratio.
Yeah. Well, also, Mailer was always trying to get out of his metaphors.
Yeah.
Right? He wanted to find that moment. Could be on his motorcycle, or it could be in the boxing ring, or it could be with a woman, or whatever. But it would be that moment where he would escape from himself. And, of course, for McLuhan, that was death.
Yeah, and McLuhan, you know, satirized existentialism, but Mailer thought he was doing the existential.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The, you know, on the early versions of my tiny note chart, the bottom-up, small bottom-up chart and top-down chart, I have Mailer versus McLuhan on it. I don't know if you ever noticed that. Don't know if you've seen those. I should send them to you, see the dynamic, because that was the, in the magazine world, that was the battle, McLuhan versus Mailer, and they had several opportunities to perform. There were the Ali Foreman fights in metaphysics, which had become content and was subject to the pagan idolatry and conflict that every other human chemical body endeavor was going through. So...
Their fight, though, is still in the future. Interesting thing that there may have been some sort of battle that people thought was going on in the 60s, but actually their battle is yet to be entered into.
Okay, yeah, the deeper aspects of their battle, what they were really fighting over. I would say they were fighting over what is art, what is the artist's role. Mailer was a traditional artist with all the romantic images. McLuhan knew the chemical body artist was not relevant at all. This thing that even Don Thiel says in his Medium is a Rear View Mirror, and the Medium is a Rear View Mirror in 1971, his book on McLuhan, he says the big value of McLuhan is he drew attention to the artist as an important person in analyzing sociological situations. That's not McLuhan's message. He was pointing out the artist was no longer available It was a new phenomenon. You had to include the collectivity of the populations are making the art products daily, daily forming the new world, the new consciousness. And then what is a figure, what's an anti-environment to that? So that's my bugaboo. When I meet art students, or in New York I met a lot of art critics, I tell them, you guys don't even know what the art critic, you have a problem in art. You guys think it's obsolete, or you discuss it, the Wall Street commodification of it. You don't even know of what the real art battle was, and that involved McLuhan giving us an explanation of where art had gone. Nobody knows that. Now, there is this Dutch woman, Shoki Van Meulen, I think her name is. I met her in New York, and she was doing a PhD on Clement Greenberg versus McLuhan. She had figured out that there was an art argument there that the art world didn't know about. It's a very good PhD. I recommend, I think, could find it online maybe. And she said it was replayed by Rosalind Krauss, who's the major editor, queen of art criticism in New York for the last 30 years or whatever, in the magazine October. You know that magazine?
No.
That journal? Okay, so that's one of the top art magazines, art reviews. It's Rosalind Krauss versus the German guy, Kittler. Do you know about him?
Well, I know the name, but I've never read a line of the guy.
Right, so he was considered the best. Beg your pardon?
I should be reading him, but I haven't.
Well, maybe not, but here's, you need to know a little bit more about him. But he was the best retrieval of McLuhan for Europeans. So he was the big European McLuhanite. He died a few years ago. And so his, it wasn't popular to use McLuhan, but he successfully retrieved McLuhan in a too literal of a way, but he got a lot of attention, a lot of honors, and made a big deal. Once McLuhan was retrieved, Kittler was right there to take the honors. Okay? But what was interesting is that Shoki said that Rosalind Krauss, her naivety about McLuhan, but she ends up saying the medium is not the message or something. She does a major essay at some point around 2000, having to acknowledge the McLuhan meme. So it's Krauss versus Kittler replaying Greenberg versus McLuhan. Does that sound interesting to you?
Sure.
Well, definitely we try to get you the PhD. It's very good. But that's the thing that I met a lot of McLuhanites who were art professors. They didn't know. They didn't think Through the Vanishing Point said anything, if they even knew about the book. But that's where he laid out a new way to do our art criticism, or at least to put on the art world, and every one of his books is putting on a particular world, right? Particular specialism, a particular profession. And that was the art critic one. And he wrote to Playboy around that time saying, responding to somebody, Leslie Fiedler, somebody talking about the, you know, forlorn state of the art world. And he said, well, we've solved that problem. Get our book, Through the Vanishing Point. We feel that we have made some explanations of the new consciousness in the art world.
Hey, notice how that relates to the take today quotation. Right? The idea of how you go to the totally new consciousness from the old consciousness, and the answer is through the vanishing point.
Right. And it's today. A new day every day, and you're living 200 years every 12 months, he said, in 1971 or so. So a lot of new take todays. So this is what's so fun to read McLuhan, to know about it and then see what happened and to see how appropriate this paragraph is, how prophetic, and a challenge. You have to get a certain understanding of McLuhan, real understanding, perception of McLuhan, to even figure out what he's talking about here.
Yes.
And then to find out that Finnegan's Wake is a recently achieved, what? How could this book be? Nobody's aware of that. How's it an achieved form of consciousness? Unless you're thinking it's an artist by himself being the leading edge, which Joyce was. But it's referring to a world that's post-Joyce in the pagan worship of art. That is subject to commodification. And John Bojard, a pretty interesting McLuhanite who cracked the code and became, because he was seeing through the art world in the 80s, they had to adopt him as the critic of the day. So there's a lot of quoting of Bojard, but probably they could have done better with McLuhan. Would have been more accessible for people.
But, I mean, what's going on there in the background is the working of language, right? The working of sort of social self-consciousness and in language, there is no such thing ultimately as the innovator or the one who deserves credit and all this stuff. Language eats all that stuff.
Yeah,
right? And the great mystery is, you know, what is going on with this huge form for which all human beings and humanity itself is a figure.
Yeah, this reminds me of an important point. With the rise of McLuhan in the 60s, the same period in pop culture was Bob Dylan. I read a book called Dylanology about the culture of Dylan's fans or even cults. It was very interesting, but I found out that at some point, you know, 15 years ago or something, they found out that Dylan got his imagery for all his raucous music in the mid-60s, you know, like a Rolling Stone or from magazine clippings and quotes from all kinds of different sources. And there's a picture on one of those early mid-60s albums, Highway 61 Revisited or whatever, and he's there sitting in a New York Park Avenue palace, and he's looking at all these magazines. So people start documenting. They could find the quotes and the images. He didn't write one. And remember, he is being hooked up for the children as a creative self-expressionist. You know what I mean? A guy with incredible imagination. Look at those crazy words. Maybe he's doing drugs or something. But it turns out he was doing McLuhan. He was just looking at media, finding images, and then sticking them in and making poems out of it, and then songs. And there was a big debate in this book. Well, it reported the debate, the struggle between certain guys had written books on Dylan and then the other guys, and they couldn't decide whether, you know, a lot of them were deflated. This guy wasn't creative. He stole everything. And here he was doing McLuhan on a pop culture, more chaotic way, but he was looking at the materials around him. And that is a best way to be a poet in that period, following in the school of McLuhan. And so the literate throwbacks of trying to find a Shelley or a Keats in Dylan are shocked that he was using pop culture images and making them part of his collage, not his own imagination. So that's you don't use your materials to be an artist by the 60s. You don't use your thoughts.
Well, you never had, but people didn't know that
before. Yeah, people didn't know that.
So he's, notice in the citation that we keep coming back to at the end of Take Today, he says, for the best part of the century, we've been programming human consciousness with retrievals and replays of the tribal unconscious. Well, that's just what you described of Dylan looking at magazines.
Right, and the one of the tribal unconscious that people don't get is the tribal unconscious that the printing press brought in. That was the beginning of a new kind of tribal consciousness.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, but it was an eyeball, literate, eyeball conscious, not the ear. And the electric age continues the process but retrieves the ear. Now, you take that image and the medium is the massage of the ear overlaying the eye, which may be, not Max Ernst, but Man Ray. Did he make that image? I'm not sure. But the thing is, I think it applied to Joyce in some way, or I took it as that way, because there's some drawing of Joyce that somebody did back in his day of his eye and his ear coming together. But
yeah, I think that was Moholy Nagy.
Moholy Nagy, yeah, right. You know, that's how they pronounce it. I was told this in New York. Moholy Nagy. It's not Nagy.
Could be. Yeah. Anyway, it's Hungarian, so it could be anything.
Right. So the McLuhan's your T.S. Eliot is the eye ear dialectic, auditory imagination.
Yes.
What is the image, if you want to use body parts, of the woke period, the Finnegan's Wake period? What McLuhan was saying was not awake yet. People weren't aware of it. Would it have been the image of the medium as a massage of the people lined up and walking into the womb of this big sculpture of a woman? Is that
maybe
that tactility?
Yeah, well, I would say that's anti-tactility. It's tactility writ large, which the wokesters can't see.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is you've got the eye ear. What is the what organ replaces that? Basically, the corpus callosum. What would be an image for the corpus callosum? So I'm just wondering about McLuhan's choice of that womb. But if you just literally took organs, I guess a lot of the psychedelic and digital art that shows the central nervous system splayed all over the place, maybe different landscapes overlaid on the brain, you know, those cliches through the years, that might be what we're looking at in the global theater. That might be appropriate images in terms of body parts. Now, that, again, we're coming to what are we made up of? How are we human, or what are we human? That's the anthropomorphic physical, which is humans thinking, and I think I've said this several times, people don't want to be embedded in the environment. They don't want to be a machine or some kind of loss of autonomy or will or personal care. And we're trying to find out where is that part of ourself. We're trying to remember the anthropomorphic, which would be the whole history of human form and all the cultural images of it, you know, from caveman to the cyborg. And it's also trying to get physical, to get anchored, to get find a ground to the post-ground melange we're in, you know, clusterfuck we're in today. Where people don't know what the ground is or if there can be. Now, yeah, that's the question is, can there be anthropomorphic physical? So we're coming into the quadrant, which is the Dobbs quadrant, of the Tai Note chart, where we are groping for an image, and it's misguided looking for the anthropomorphic physical. We need to become aware of that drive to save that. The urge, the unwoke condition of looking for an anthropomorphic physical. Not that we have to, you know, go non-human, non-anthropomorphic, but that is what's driving so much, is people are arguing over how do you relate the cyborg to traditional theology, say, to the image of the human and its divinity, or not.
People are increasingly conscious, both because of their personal problems, their interpersonal problems, the international problems, the economic problems, et cetera, et cetera. People are increasingly conscious that there are problems to which we don't know the answers, and we desperately need to have answers.
Yeah, and the answers have been tried, and the ones we knew, the anthropomorphic answers even, didn't work.
Correct.
Because we've been stretched out in this condition since 1945, like I said. We never left 1945. We're just layering information over on information. But it's interesting how every decade there was an attempt or a mood that, oh, we can do something about this. Let's have a movement. And they tried. And none of them worked. And we were stuck here for, 80 years of floating here in this limbo, of trying everything and having to and knowing, some of us, that none of it was going to work because we didn't know what we were up against. We didn't understand it.
Correct. And look at how the Nazi episode in the Canadian Parliament perfectly expresses this. right? We're right back in 1945.
Yeah, we covered that in office hours today, you know, Clinton and I and Greg, because we did a video version of ourselves. We did that a year or two ago, but then it wasn't working. But now we have better equipment, so we did it. So Greg and Clinton, I was aware of it a bit, but they brought the footage that we showed of the ridiculous scene in Parliament. The people applauding this old doddering guy, 98 years old, didn't even know where he was. He's worse than Biden. And they all over the weekend thought, oh, Jesus, that was Adolf Hitler, not a nice guy from Calgary. And then they all start, you know, pointing fingers at each other, and the Speaker of the House, he's gone already.
That's right.
Their own party kicked out their guy. And the footage they were showing me, I didn't know that he'd get kicked out till after they showed the footage. And he's there. He made a ridiculous, you know, trying to be funny and celebrating the guy up in the gallery. And it's so Canadian and pompous and fragile and silly. It's Monty Python almost. And then I found out he's the first casualty. He had to step down the other day or today or something. What a story.
He had to take the blame for Trudeau. And,
But your point is, yes, we're back, and we never left 1945, and it's a big scandal. We found out we never left it.
That was your point, Bob.
Beg your pardon?
That was your point.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Again, I was the prophet once again. I forgot to put that point in that story back to my 1945 famous aphorism. So pretty good. Anyways,
I wanted to ask you a question about the anthropomorphic physical. Sometimes you seem to use it in a fairly positive sense, and other times in a negative sense, and I can easily believe that it has both. But for example, if you say that people are looking for the anthropomorphic physical, do you mean that in a good sense? And that a valuable goal to have or an interesting goal to have, or do you mean that it's a misguided goal?
You can be assured, Clinton, after talking to him all day on the show, you can be assured, Cameron, if I talk about it, I'm not for it. To quote a wag, which is a word I learned from McLuhan. I didn't know there were wags, W-A-G, started saying it. But, I'm saying that's the knee-jerk natural program, in quotes.
Good.
That is an effect.
Yeah.
And me personally know this because I'm dealing with the post-anthropomorphic every day, and that's ion, for freak's sake. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have a whole agenda there. Remember, the tiny note chart, in my terms, predicted ion. I didn't know that, but that's what happened. That's the waiting. Remember at the bottom, it says, waiting for organic bodies, the spinning clothing crystals have danced the hex advertisement. So my chart is an advertisement, and it includes the anthropomorphic physical as part of the content. Part of the effects, the spinning, waiting for organic bodies, that's waiting for the AP at a certain level. The environments are spinning clothing crystals.
Yeah, and the hexatic, that's six, right?
Yeah, that's, the chart is pointing to the hidden ground that's surfacing. And I did this in 1995, I didn't show up till 14 years later, but I was trying to point out the obsolescence of Wired and the chip body and the chip landscape, because I was always trying to one-up everybody by saying, well, you're missing the hidden ground, which that's what any good student of McLuhan learns to do, right? So I was trying to point to something. Now, where did I get even a notion of it? Well, Carolyn, we were in New York, and Walter Fishman had invented this gadget, which was called MIHR, stood for MIHR, Magnetically Influenced Homeopathic Remedies or Herbal Remedies. And it was made up of a little little vaccination box, and the needle had a liquid in it, which was herbs that had been homeopathized. It made into a liquid and made, you know, invisible. Homeopathy is sub-known kind of stuff. And so you take herbs, you homeopathize, make a liquid, you put that in a syringe needle, and you inject it into an acupuncture point while putting a electromagnetic pulse on it as it goes into the system. And it treated AIDS wonderfully. We had an AIDS solution, and then a lot of shit happened. And people objected to it, and the American Medical Association started to hassle Carolyn, because Walter died. When we got there in August 93, he died within a couple of weeks. And I hadn't even gotten there. I was still in L.A. So Carolyn was on her own with the widow. And they did really good stuff. And then Mario Cuomo passed a law in 1994. He was governor of New York, saying that alternative medicine cannot be hassled anymore, told the AMA to back off. And so they had 3 years, 94, 95, 6, 7, up to 98, to implement the program. And they had a clinic and were doing really good work. And it was working. And then all of a sudden, the AMA was creeping around, and they started attacking people, ignoring Cuomo's rules or legislation. And probably they had more power than Cuomo, and so they had to stop it. They wouldn't let Carolyn send the technology outside of New York City. We weren't allowed to send it to other states, so it got stopped. But then that led on to where we are today, which is even more powerful technologies medically. So the so I was aware of what this technology was doing, and it was a strange new thing that could not be explained. You know, it brought together herbs, homeopathy, acupuncture, and magnetic stimulation that nobody knew about, not very much in medicine. They didn't. These were underground modalities, just starting to surface. Now they're well known, but we're talking 30 years ago. And I was looking at that and trying to figure out what was the energy, what was the media effects of this thing if it got implemented. That's what inspired the chart. And that's her technology. The MIR device was a hexadic instrument. It was beyond all known systems of physics and chemistry and biology at that point. Now, we got even greater versions of that with ION, our cold play, our endless electricity device, which is being used in Augusta, Georgia, in a big way. And then we have our medical stuff that we're going to release, which is phenomenal. So that's what made me want to make a chart, right? I wanted to explain. And then the personal level was, okay, Carolyn's the leading edge. She's part of the PR for this technology. And it's obsolescing the patriarchal Gutenberg male-dominated knowledge systems. So I said, wait a minute, Carolyn. There's a few guys that actually contribute something you feminist takeovers should acknowledge, and that's the names on the chart. LaRouche, Mae Brussel, Zappa, McLuhan, William Irwin Thompson, Cosmic Awareness, a medium, Arthur Croker, Dr. Beter, my mentor in Halifax, Dartmouth, Garrett Dean, and myself in there, 10 people. And they were the men that were worth remembering by the women. Now, where did I get this idea that women were taking over? I knew Peggy Mellon, who's on the Rockefeller level, through Walter Bord. He was married to her. And she was out in Tucson, and I knew she had a very interesting life, so I offered in early 99, because she would come to New York and get treated with MIR. So here was a very wealthy billionaire person who could be influential and support this technology and promote it. We already had the nephew of the Shah of Iran promoting it. We also had Elizabeth Taylor and Malcolm Forbes doing it. But that's the whole early 88 to 91 story. We show up in 93. So you'll see on the tiny note chart, Magic Johnson. He was treated by our technology for AIDS. And he did well. But the interviewed Peggy Mellon. The idea was for her to talk about her life, and this would be a letter to her daughters, because nobody corresponded anymore like she did when she grew up. And she was born in 1933, and she's still alive. She lives on the Big Island, one of the Hawaiian islands called the Big Island. Technically, it's called Hawaii, that island. We do like 13 evenings, an hour and a half. She's laying out her life. And she knew everybody, interacted with everybody. At that point, she was a big supporter of the Dalai Lama in what was called Tibet House. And this is 1999. And she got herself worked up and thought, I would really like to talk to my mother about what's going on. And so I knew a really good psychic. So she had an experience. She had a session with the psychic and talked to her mother. And then I came in after that and interviewed her. This was going to be the last episode. And she told me that her mother said, the men have failed. You women are taking over. Now, Peggy already was an activist. She was always trying to help different versions of women's movements, not just the Gloria Steinem world, other aspects of it. So her mother maybe knew that and said, get your act together. Notice it's all about women. They're taking over, and men aren't going to make it. They're just going to fail. Okay, so I had already made my chart with that in my mind in 95. So 4 years later, the astral plane kind of confirms what I was thinking of, you know? So,
back up for a second. What do you mean the astral plane sort of confirms?
Well, her mother was dead.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, she came through a psychic lady.
Yeah, okay. And, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and I actually met her in 1998. I went to Peggy's home in Upper East Side of New York, and the matriarch was there. She was a fashion queen in like the 1920s, and she married a guy who was a amazing scene maker. He may have had something to do with Rolls Royce, and he made a successful airplane engine during World War II that helped the Americans. And he was flying it in 1944, and it crashed. And he died. So she lost her father. Peggy lost her father at the age of 11. But Sarnoff, because he was a high guy in society due to his wife, Peggy's mother, he was friends of the elite, you know, Sarnoff and everybody that McLuhan writes about. And Sarnoff gave the Mellon family, his name was Hitchcock, so it was the Hitchcock family, early TV. So she was experiencing TV as like a seven-year-old in 1940, was in her home, an early TV, made by, you know, Philo Farnsworth, the American inventor of television. So remember, Sarnoff ripped him off. Anyways, she as a privileged person bumped into all kinds of leading edges all over the place. I mean, she became a big advocate of Tim Leary and Millbrook. Millbrook is her estate that she gave Leary for him to do his drug experiments in, you know, 63, 64, 65. That big building up in Millbrook, that was her offering to the scene. She funded the first Grateful Dead album. They wouldn't have been able to make it without her. They were nobodies at that point. So now I'm saying this, that I saw Carolyn as symbolic of a female sensibility, right hemisphere or something, even though I was not being a knee-jerk literalist. I knew it was corpus callosum and actually didn't involve men. The battle between men and women was obsolete and not really what was going on. But the fact is, Carolyn was working with the newest, best technology available. And then you know, Peggy's mother confirmed my scenario. She might have even picked up what I was thinking and gave it to her daughter, you know. So those are all thoughts of what the anthropomorphical is for me. It's obsolete. It's not the sixth quadrant. Okay? So this whole digression about the what I've just laid out, our personal events in our lives, went into the chart. And that's where I got the obsolescence of the anthropomorphical. I knew that we were going to create a new form in ourselves, a new kind of physical. And we were going to witness the projection of nostalgia for the archetypal human form, even, you know, romantic images and archetypes like they are the Atlanteans. They were us. They were more advanced than we were. You know, people try to retrieve these ancient archetypes in theosophical literature, anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner. That's another anthropomorphic projection. So I eventually came up with the five bodies in that period as a way, the interplay of the five bodies is the grappling of the anthropomorphical physical. To the degree, I mean, there are many people trying to, you take the Jackass movement. Did you know about them?
No.
They were guys in the 90s who would film themselves, videotape themselves, you know, beating themselves up, doing ridiculous things, shoving things up their bum, leaping on things, and, you know, basically breaking their legs all the time. And they were called Jackasses. So this was a fad, a big one, in the 90s, where people were using their bodies as a weapon, as a bludgeon. So that was people trying to feel the anthropomorphic form on the chemical body level. Others were, then you have the extropians who want to merge with the digital and go cyborg and disappear into the matrix. That movement, right?
So am I correct if when you say, talk about the chemical body level as an example, I think what you're doing is you're talking about the chemical body in the context of all of the bodies.
Yes.
The chemical body having a certain emphasis or a certain...
nostalgia. People think they're five senses. They have no clue. Now they do, more and more, and it's been forced on them. They've woke through the multi-bodied scenario. They're not experts at describing it, but people realize that virtual reality is invading them and becoming part of their bodies. And Croker's pretty good at describing this effect in the 90s in his colorful language. So the interplay of the body, so right now at this late stage, you have people romanticizing, looking for divinity or balance or security in the different bodies. You got the young kids who all want to become famous. They want to become a news broadcaster or something in the TV body. That's one level of charisma. There's those hackers who want to become digital and cyborgs. Or who was the guy that became very popular in the 90s? Oh, yeah, Ray Schiller. Who's that guy? The Spiritual Destiny of Machines. Ray. He's a big deal. He's the main.
Yeah. Starts with K.
Yeah, Kurzweil or something.
Kurzweil. Yeah.
His book comes out in the 90s. He's celebrating the chip body and thinking it's going to be an anthropomorphic security form. I mean, they would say, well, we really are cyborgs. That's our real self, and we're discovering our layers of onion, and we discover our chip body is what we really are, and we should accept that and become that.
Right.
So William Aaron Thompson was his books were interesting in the 90s. He was in between the conflict, and he'd make fun of Ray Kurzweil. He'd make fun of the Jackass people. You know, he was in the interval. He knew enough to this was all anthropomorphic. He didn't use that term, I don't think, but he would understand what I was saying back then, and I knew him then. And I didn't talk about the five bodies with him. I did give him a picture. I did give him the chart, which I don't know if he did anything with. All he asked me to do one day, and remember, he was considered the replacement of McLuhan in the early 70s by the Toronto columnist, forget his name, Richard Needham. He Zingroni tells the story, Frank Zingroni, that Needham did a review of Thompson's powerful book called At the Edge of History, which greatly influenced by McLuhan, and his friend Frank Zingroni. They went to the McLuhan lecture at MIT or Harvard in 65, and that was a big event in their own lives. So Thompson what was I saying? I gave him the chart. He's
you were
on
talking
the chart.
About what he asked you to do something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The only thing he asked me to do in this course is lectures at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York was to explain the tetrad. He hadn't got his head around that yet. So all he wanted was a tetrad. He didn't know this advanced Bob stuff of the five bodies. And this was in 4, 95, 96. Now, he did a book in 96 called Coming into Being. After being at David Rockefeller's funded institute around Terence McKenna Center for Integral Studies or something in San Francisco. So Bill was the Lindisfarne thing. That was funded by David Rockefeller on the East Coast. But he was invited out to San Francisco, and he found that the kids there and whoever was there, all ages, were just into the drugs and psychedelic San Francisco reality and had no background in reading and literature and books, which Bill really was, a guy trying to be a great author. So he comes back, and he's talking to us in 96. He has his new book there, and he's handing out copies to us. But he reads the foreword, a section of it, and he talks about how we need to he describes how what a shock it was where the kids were going in the mid-90s. He didn't like it, and he missed the interaction with literate people and the sophisticated conversation. So he's celebrating coming back to the cathedral and our group, and then he makes a special plea, read McLuhan. He gave us a warning. So he's taking the angle that McLuhan is saying this literacy, which Bill is reappreciating, is what a major value we got to preserve. So he's a bit of a POB, print-oriented bastard there. But anyways, he cites McLuhan in the values he now is dedicated to. Forget the psychedelic stuff. And when he read that, a few people in the audience looked over at me. They knew and winked at me. They knew I caused that. I was the McLuhan guy. And the first couple of years I was there, when I would bring up McLuhan, eventually we'd always go to a restaurant and talk after. And then people would always come up to me and say, who is this McLuhan guy, and why are you talking about him? Why is he important? And I would explain it to these people. They had no clue. And so they were shocked when Bill cited me, so to speak, in his foreword in his new book. So that's why I put him on the chart. He actually was on the chart a year before in 95, but I handed him the chart in 97. I had a paper copy, so I don't know what he did with it. He gave up Lindisfarne. He got very disillusioned and became a poet, emphasized his poet self from 2000 till he died. And he died the day Trump lost. Around that time, first week in November 2020, is when he died. He was born in 1938. So why, okay, I'm trying to give you different thoughts and scenes of a part of my life that formulated the AP and what I was trying to point to as a limited metaphor. So that's why it's very appropriate that I'm the figure in that quadrant. I'm not in TV. I'm not in the computer world. I'm not in the book world. I'm not in the newspaper world. I was in the world exploring after all that had its orgasm and the Minerva's Owl effect. I was walking around New York City seeing that this was, I was St. Augustine, as I told you before, you know, walking around the collapse of the bodies, the collapse of all this evolution. Cultural technological evolution, and that's what I was talking about. So I consider myself dealing with the post-human era, but which is not the right term. What is it? I'm I'm talking about what actually came about, which is ION, which is we're making new technologies. So he's the new Edison, or it is the new Edison, and making the new grounds. That's what I represented. And that was the sixth level. And ION now talks about the chart very intelligently and agrees with what I'm saying, that ION is the hexadic environment that we were creating and predicting. So that is what we're getting into here with the AP, and we're going to move towards the tech body, which is something ION revealed, which goes beyond the Android meme. So the tech body is playing with people's different versions of the anthropomorphic physical, manipulating that rearview mirror response. And what time is it? I think that's a good place to end. You can say a couple points or even have a question or two, but I think I've got us up to that page 160, the anthropomorphic
physical. That's great. That's the new chapter.
Yeah.
And, I would just say that the thing that I'm going to pay particular attention to in going further in the pamphlet is something we've talked about in the past, and that is the relationship between the Android meme, the anthropomorphic physical, and the tech body.
That's it. That's what the chart's about, the tiny note chart. Because the first four quadrants are the Android meme, and then the AP is a little past that, but I didn't know that would become the tech body. And the tech body is a competitor with ION.
Yeah, that I understand. But what I don't understand is, from your conversation today, I would have said that the anthropomorphic physical was a set of goals that each of which could be used to describe the five bodies.
Yeah, I would agree with your words as far as they go. That's I have said that. The projection of people looking for a new ground, an anchor, though there's the conservatives want to bring back the chemical body. The woke people, they want to bring in the TV body, dealing with cultural tribalism and recognizing each icon, each tribe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you've got the Ray Kurzweil's diving into the chip body. That's his anthropomorphic physical. He thinks that's the future. That's what is our core essence or something. And then you have the astral body, which on the surface is what ION is from. See, you got the chemical body, the astral body, and then you got the TV body, which is a replay of the chemical body, and then the chip is a replay or an extension of the astral body. If you look at the astral body and the chemical body as the first nature, and then second nature is the TV body and the chip body. So the chip body redoes the astral part of first nature, and the TV body redoes and extends the physical body or chemical body of the first nature.
Mm-hmm. And is there a mystery body?
Yes. The fifth part is the mystery body. That's what Mir showed me, that there's things that we can do that our science hasn't figured out and wouldn't be able to explain. So it prepared me for what we were making with ION. So we were really lucky to experience the mirror thing. I mean, it mm-hmm. actually could solve the AIDS problem for people. That's a major thing at that point in the 90s. So so I said, okay, there's aspects we're going to discover that we don't know about, and we'll be surprised by it. So I call that the mystery landscape. I didn't call it a body yet. But when ION showed up and ION got well-versed in my chart, he said, well, Bob, we're here to explain the mystery landscape and show you the mystery body, which should become old hat and cliche knowledge once people learn from us and ION what the mystery landscape is. The point was to to de-romanticize or demythologize the mystery landscape. So that is pretty close to another aspect of the anthropomorphic physical. That's like the fantasy body, you know, the Harry Potter world, that there's something, some great knowledge that we have forgotten or are going to find. And it's McLuhan's line, mysticism is tomorrow, science, dream today. That's him pointing to the mystery body becoming known, becoming manageable.
Yeah. And all these things are highly ambiguous, right? So the mystery body can be something stupid like Harry Potter.
Yep.
I got a dog here going nuts. I don't know why.
Because he knows what we're talking about. He agrees. The mystery body is commenting on us. But what you're saying is right. That's the philosophical questions I'm exploring. What is it? We may, you know, maybe the anthropomorphic physical in its five parts are what we have to juggle as quadriphenics, and that's a healthy response. That's polyvocal. Dealing with environments that were landscapes that then were miniaturized into bodies. Or croakers, you know, organs without bodies.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I'm gradually learning the lingo here, and it's an interesting way of looking at stuff in McLuhan and beyond McLuhan. So,
yeah.
Good. So we'll get into that in more detail next time.
Yeah, there might be a few quotes after this. There's not that much after. That quote we just did is a good conclusion. And now we get into the Endromeme and the AP, or what I've done from page 160 on to 180-something. So,
yeah.
So this is, we finally got to the new form of consciousness, I guess, that we're living in. So what is it? How do you describe it? How do you, like you say, what part of language do you use? Which languages do you use to deal with this drive of the anthropomorphic physical? Okay.
Yeah, well, there's what part of language do you use, or what part of language do you need to be used by? And if you need to be used by, which is a kind of passivity, how do you get to passivity without
masochism?
Sorry?
Without masochism.
That's good, yeah. The dog happened to bark just as you said that, and I didn't hear the word. But
yeah.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, there's a knot of activity and passivity, and grappling with that knot is an important part of where we're at.
Yep. Okay, well, we'll let the dog have the last word. So great talking to you, Cameron.
Okay, Bob, take care.
Yeah, talk soon.
Enjoy that.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.